The EU says Tehran's response to its latest proposal on the revival of the JCPOA was reasonable as Iran slams the U.S. for a delay in issuing a response. Palestinian inmates begin a hunger strike in protest at an escalation in Israeli violations in prison. The detainees say they will strike for another 2 weeks. And supporters of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan gather outside his home to prevent his possible detention. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran says that the U.S. is to blame for the delay in an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal.
What matters so far is the U.S. foot dragging in giving a response. The U.S. government is responsible for the current condition of the JCPOA and the failure to implement the agreement. We can move to the next stage if the U.S. shows its serious political will in action.
The spokesman also said Iran responded to the draft text proposed by the European Union in a constructive manner. Kanani said Tehran has shown ample flexibility in the talks, but he noted that a few very important issues remain to be settled before a deal is cut. The spokesman added that the U.S. and Europe need an agreement more than Iran. He said the country wants a sustainable deal that protects its legitimate interests.
We have repeatedly emphasized that we want a good, a strong, and enduring deal. A good agreement, in our view, is one that protects Iran's national interests, is sustainable, and is based on a time frame, so Iran can ensure the other side is honoring its obligations.
The spokesman added that Iran is not going to wait forever for the West's response and will not tie the national economy to the talks. Tehran submitted its response to the EU's proposed draft a week ago. The U.S. says it is still studying Iran's response. EU's foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell now says Iran's response to the EU proposal has been reasonable. The nuclear deal was thrown into chaos when former U.S. President Donald Trump walked out of it and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Tehran now wants guarantees that the U.S. will not abandon the pact again. Political commentator Sayed Mustafa Khoshchish says it is the West and Europe in particular which stand to suffer if a deal to revive the JCPOA is not reached.
The Americans have apparently not provided a fully yes answer. When they sent their reply to the EU, Mora would immediately send that positive reply to Iran. I don't know if they would say, something half and half or something like no, but it's to their detriment. It's to their loss, you know. Europe is now grappling with the outcomes of the Ukraine war and rising energy prices. In about a couple of weeks, 3-4 weeks from now, when pre-fall or pre-cold season oil purchases start, the prices would rise. And even if Americans released more of their strategic reserves, again, prices would rise because as it lowers, the U.S. strategic reserves, it leaves a negative impact on the market and the prices start to rise. Right now, we are seeing the introductory or preliminary signs of this problem in Europe. Europe is paying a higher price for lack of energy and energy prices, rising energy prices, and in future, in the cold season, they would pay more. So Americans know it, Europeans know it. If they were really logical, especially the Americans, they would take whatever they could right now and give Iran a positive answer. Because in about a few weeks' time, nations in the West, the United States and especially Europe, they would pay a higher price. And the leverage on them would be heavier. This is no secret.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Ahmed Abdollahian is heading to Mali as Tehran seeks to boost ties with African countries. The top Iranian diplomat will arrive in the capital, Bamako, on the first leg of his Africa tour. He will later travel to Tanzania and its semi-autonomous region of Zanzibar to hold talks with senior officials there. Prior to his trip, Amir Abdollahian said developing ties with Africa remains a priority of the government of President Ibrahim Raisi. He said joint commercial and industrial meetings will be held during his visit to the African states. Yemeni officials say world bodies, including the UN, lack integrity and transparency in their humanitarian work in the war-torn country, where millions of people struggle each and every day to get themselves some food. Abdulatif Awashali reports.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore, they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Programme said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels.
Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen to be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Abdulatif Alwashali, Sana'a.
The top Israeli court has rejected an appeal for a release of the Palestinian prisoner who has been on hunger strike for 172 days. According to Khalil Awada's lawyer, the court turned down the request and affirmed the decision to freeze his administrative detention. Awada was supposed to be freed on September 15th, but the court denied the request after Israel's internal spy agency, Shin Bet, handed over a confidential file to the judge. The Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad has also demanded Awada's release as part of a ceasefire that ended the three-day Israeli aggression on Gaza earlier this month. Awada has been on hunger strike since March 4th to protest his administrative detention, a policy Israel follows to indefinitely imprison Palestinians without charge or trial. Palestinian prisoners resume mass hunger strike action to protest mistreatment in Israeli jails. The detainees say their two-week action also aims to protest repeated inspection of cells by Israeli prison guards. The inmates say that Israel's actions violate its March agreement with the Palestinian Commission of Detainees Affairs. The agreement ended the previous mass hunger strike by thousands of Palestinian prisoners. The commission now says it will not discourage the prisoners from claiming their rights, and it is ready to confront any violations by Israeli prison service. Our correspondent Mona Kendall is with us with all the latest regarding this recent story. Mona, tell us more about the situation of the Palestinian prisoners.
Well, in addition to this reason why Palestinian prisoners would be engaged in a mass hunger strike for 2 weeks, it's because the Israeli prison administration decided to announced a set of repressive measures against Palestinian prisoners in general and against the long-term Palestinian prisoners. Some Palestinian prisoners spending over 20 years in Israeli jails and they are facing strict measures behind bars, like, let's say, the transferring of Palestinian prisoners from a cell to another, those long-term prisoners, every couple months. It's very difficult on the prisoner, if, this Palestinian prisoners who spent over 20 years, and sometimes they received two and three life sentences behind bars when they are used to their atmosphere in a specific prisoner, they are used to their fellow prisoners as well. Here comes the strict measures, not having, let's say, flexibility in receiving their family members. They only receive them every couple of months, and not all family members are allowed to visit their imprisoned, let's say, sons and daughters in Israeli jails. In March, Palestinian prisoners had been carrying out a hunger strike, but they agreed to suspend this move after there was an agreement with the Israeli prison administration. And as you have mentioned, it's very serious for them, not only the move to start a hunger strike, but also there are numerous moves would be taken by the Palestinian prisoners. And this comes also at a time when Palestinian prisoner Khalil Al-Awadi, this administrative detainee who had been on a hunger strike for over 172 days, the Israeli regime first agreed to suspend his administrative detention in order to allow him to stop his hunger strike. But his lawyer kept insisting that he has to be released in order to end his hunger strike because he's in a very serious health condition. Yesterday, the Israeli military court decided that they will not release Khalil Al-Awadi at the moment, and the, he would be held in the Israeli jail hospital. Then he would be returned back to the Israeli jail, of course.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Mona Kendall, from Ramallah. Now, hundreds of supporters of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan have gathered outside his home in the capital Islamabad in a bid to prevent his detention. That comes as police charge Khan of breaching the country's anti-terror law for allegedly threatening government officials. In a public speech on Saturday, Khan said he, quote, would not spare Islamabad's police chief and a female judge over the arrest and purported torture of his aide. His close aide faces sedition charges for inciting mutiny in the powerful military. Khan was unseated in a no-confidence vote in April, over a week after several members of his ruling coalition switched sides. He is accused of political and economic failures, but Khan insists that he has fallen victim to a U.S.-backed regime change plot. Russia accuses Ukraine's secret services of being behind the murder of the daughter of Alexander Dugin, a veteran philosopher and theorist known for his staunch anti-West views. Russia's Federal Security Service has identified the attacker as Natalia Vovk, a Ukrainian woman in her 40s. It says the woman conducted a controlled explosion of a car of Darya Dugina, who was driving. Darya was returning from an event on the outskirts of Moscow where her father was delivering a lecture. The report says that the assailant and her teenage daughter arrived in Russia in July and were preparing for the attack. They reportedly fled to Estonia. Alexander Dugin is said to have been the intended target, but he was due to leave the venue in the same car and at the last minute decided to travel separately. Darya was a journalist and a political expert. A Ukrainian presidential advisor had denied Kiev's role behind the attack. Western countries stick with their policy of sanctions against Russia despite the economic backlash. The West says that the sanctions are meant to pressure Russia to end its war on Ukraine, but regardless of whether their policy produced any results, the measures are taking their toll both on local economies and food supply across the world.
It is widely believed that the war in Ukraine is causing a global food crisis. But how could this be true? Ukraine is one of the world's biggest exporters of green essentials, like wheat and corn. But most of its products can't even leave the country. This is causing serious problems in places where they depend most on this supply, like the Middle East and Africa. There's so many ripple effects from the war, but it's hard to overstate just how big the impact of the grain crisis is. Along with the shortages, you've also got the rising prices of fertilizers and fuel, as well as natural disasters due to climate change like drought, which has only further worsened the situation globally. And now UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of a global food crisis as the West's anti-Russia stance is creating obstacles to the flow of Russian products and fertilizers to the world. Guterres said that the global food crisis triggered by the Ukraine conflict looms over the world. The UN chief says the West's sanctions on Russia have exacerbated the poor situation of the global economy.
Well, they are trying to use all kinds of arguments. Some are, real, based on something. Some are absolutely spurious and based on nothing, to somehow get the public opinion against Russia. And that concerns this story of grain. You know, Russia and other countries produce, much more grain than Ukraine. So the very idea that Africa will somehow starve, not because of misguided Western policies, not because of the prices which, West commands, but because five boats of grain which cannot leave Odessa, it's a joke. There were tons of possibilities for even that grain to go, and there is endless amount of possibilities to get grain from Russia, from France, and so on. So that was all mobilized by Ukraine to somehow turn the opinions that it's like all Russia fault. Children are dying in Africa, Russian fault, isn't it? And unfortunately, Antonio Guterres, rather than approaching the whole thing objectively, coming to the, territory, exploring it, asking questions, saying, what can we do? He more or less channels the information which is given to him by Ukraine.
But despite this, only a few nations seem to be pushing for diplomatic efforts in an attempt to restore the global supply chains, and other countries, mainly the US and its allies, continue their anti-Russia stance, pushing ahead with their foreign policy.
With that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The seizure of Palestinian cultural materials by the Zionist regime does not stop with the physical act of confiscation. The Israeli regime hides the materials in its archives, limiting access and preventing their exposure. Tel Aviv, meanwhile, classifies materials in an inaccurate and biased manner that suits the Zionist narrative. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Rana Sila, researcher. This article is published under the heading How Zionist Regime Erases Palestinian Cultural Memory. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime looting of Palestinian cultural and historical archives since the first half of the 20th century has been exposed and discussed for only around the past two decades. The seized Palestinian archives, collections and materials, cultural and otherwise, were typically surveyed and studied by the Zionist regime's intelligence and transferred to the pre-regime and regime's colonial archives, both military and civilian. In many cases, Palestinian cultural property looted by individuals was also put in the Zionist regime's official archives. An archive serving to preserve historical memory would catalog the context, origin, purpose, and authors of the materials, all of which would be easy to glean in the case of these materials seized by the fake regime of Israel. The Zionist regime's purpose, however, is not to preserve Palestinian historical memory, but to erase it from the public sphere. Therefore, Palestinian materials are not catalogued and treated according to archival standards and conventions, but are instead subjected to colonial ones. The seizure of Palestinian cultural materials does not stop with the physical act of confiscation. The Zionist regime hides the materials in its archives, limiting access and preventing their exposure. The Israeli regime, meanwhile, classifies materials in an inaccurate and biased manner that suits the Zionist narrative. For example, the materials looted from Beirut are listed in the Zionist regime's military archives as the PLO archive, a body that never existed. Some individual Israelis are directly responsible for the looting of Palestinian materials in wartime and during military operations, but the Zionist regime, society as a whole, is implicated. Erasure is central to Israeli regime apartheid, and citizens, including artists, creators and film directors, not just the military, politicians and archive personnel, they play a role in the colonial process of elimination of Palestinian past. The 2018 exhibition Stolen Arab Art at Tel Aviv Center for Art and Politics included screenings of video works by famous Arab artists without their consent, knowing permission would be denied due to the cultural boycott of the Zionist regime. The exhibition was thus widely condemned within the Israeli regime art world. This is hardly the only case of Israelis using Palestinian cultural materials without their author's permission, thereby replicating colonial methods of erasure and control. While Stolen Arab Art forthrightly indicated that the display violated the creator's rights, the 2021 documentary A Real War, Shalal by Karnit Mandel, misleadingly implies that footage by Palestinian revolutionary filmmakers was included with the permission of its owners. In A Real War, Mandel discovers where the films were taken from. Much of the relevant information is in the credits of the film, so the supposed discovery is relatively minor, but does not bother to interview with their creators or their families. Mandel's film emerges as another colonial act in the ongoing destructive movement against Palestinian culture and history. Mandel sought permission to use material from Sapri Geris, the last director of the Palestine Research Center, established in 1965 while it was still based in Beirut. Academic in nature, it was founded to document and research Palestinian history and to publish books and articles devoted to the subject. Whether juries has authority to grant such permission is not addressed in the film. The principal doubt, how does one ask permission from someone that does not have the authority to give such permission, does not come up.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tonight's majlis is to commemorate the shahadat of our fourth Imam, Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salatu wa salam. Among his writings, Sahif al-Sajjadiyya is the one which is very famous. Collection of du'as that he actually gave to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir and his other son Zayd al-Shaheed. So we actually have the sanad of that Sahif al-Sajjadiyya from both these sons of the fourth Imam. But there is another book which is not that well known as Risalat al-Huquq, the Charter of Rights, written by Imam Zain al-Abidin. And this was actually narrated by, again, Abu Hamza al-Fumali, who was also, later on, he was in the companionship of the 5th and the 6th Imam also. And he was a very reliable, source for us as far as the wisdom of the 6th Imam, the 4th Imam is concerned, to the extent that the 6th Imam actually praises Abu Hamza by saying that the status of Abu Hamza in his own time was like the state of Salman Farsi during his own time. It was the same status that Salman had among his companions and in group. You know, Abu Hamza Fumali had that status among his companion and during his own time. And this Risalat al-Huquq basically has been narrated by him, and it has come to us through him. In that Risalat al-Huquq, the Charter of Rights, Imam actually talks about 50 legal and moral rights. Fiqhi and akhlaqi, huquq. It is not actually a book of fiqh. It's not a document of jurisprudence. It is more a document of ethics and morality. It is more to do with akhlaq. So, for example, if you want to know how to do the namaz, you look at fiqh. But if you want to understand what is the soul of namaz, you look at Risalat al-Huquq. So there is it basically complements. You learn fiqh from one side, but then you learn the akhlaq from the other side. And these two things have to be together. And this is where I would like to, take this opportunity to briefly introduce this to the brothers and the sisters here. Hopefully you will pay attention to that Risalat al-Huquq of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salatu wassalam. Salawat upon the Ikbarah. See, when we talk about the issue of huquq, this is plural of haq. Haq means right. This is a very complex, social concept in the society. And these days is the era of rights. There was a time when people used to talk about duties, but now they've forgotten that. That has been replaced with rights. So you have human rights, workers' rights, women's rights, children's rights, men's rights, we're still far away from that. But, so in any area you see, it's all about rights, rights, rights. And basically, this is, in the Western context, is more a relatively a new concept, starting with the French Revolution. So it's not that far. Because before the French Revolution, the society had an idea that you had the king and the citizens. All the rights belongs to the king. And all the duties are on the citizens. They didn't have any rights at all. And when we look at Islam, we see that, you know, Islam looks at it from a very different angle. And it's, interestingly, this is what I would say, that we should always be proud of the madhab of Ahlul Bayt. You will not find a clear definition of rights, this concept of huquq, in any other schools of thought in the Muslim world. And the first time where it has been explained in detail is actually in a very interesting context, by none other than the grandfather of Imam Sajjad, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam. Not only that, Ali is the first one in the history of Islam actually to clearly define what is haqq, what does it mean? When we talk about, you know, from the social aspect, but the place where he mentioned it in the khutbah that he gave about it is very interesting. And it's actually a miracle. When you look at, you know, many books on philosophy, theology, jurisprudence, this and that, you always think that, you know, this must have come from the scholar who was in an environment of learning, you know, in the university, in the Hawza. But this khutbah by Amir al-Mu'mineen was not given in Medina or in Kufa. It was not given in a masjid. Ali did not give this detailed description of the concept of huquq on a member. Ali gave this khutbah in Siffin. Just think about it. You know, he's there actually. It's a battle going on for a long time. They were there for about few months. About 2 or 3 months. Yet Amir al-Mu'mineen found time there to gather his companions and deliver this khutbah, which is there in Ahlul Balagha as well as in Usul al-Kafi. And there, this is the first time you see in Islamic literature that he talks about it. He says, I am your ruler. You are my citizens. This is centuries before French Revolution came. And what does he say? He says, by placing me over your affairs, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created my right over you. As a hakim, I have a right on you. But immediately he says, you too have a right over me like mine over you. So huquq cannot be one-sided. He says, hakim has the haqq, as well as those who are the citizens, they also have the haqq. And then he says something which is actually the foundation of this concept in Shi'i Islam. He says, لا يجري لأحد إلا جرى عليه. He says, no right can exist for a person unless it is also against him. ولا يجري عليه إلا جرى له. And no right can go against a person unless it is also in his favor. What is he talking about? He says, if you have a haqq, the other side of the coin is farz. If you have a haqq and a right, it will always be coupled with a duty on the other side. And if you have a duty, the other side of the coin would be haqq. So you cannot separate this issue of haqq and farz from one another. Wherever you talk about haqq and rights, realize that immediately in that same context, there will also be a duty on you. If there is a haqq in your favor, there is also a duty upon you. And if there is duty on you, there is also a haq relevant to it for you. This reciprocal, connection of huquq with one another, it says the only being, entity who is exempted from that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah is the one who created huquq. But when it comes to human beings, he says, doesn't matter. Whether you are the ruler or the ruled, if you have haq, the other party also has haq. And both of them also, when they have haq, they also have farz relevant to that haq.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyum وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Government documents that President Donald J. Trump had accumulated were with him in roughly 24 boxes in the White House residence. They were to go to the National Archives, but at least some of the top secret and confidential documents ended up in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Maggie Haberman, Katie Banner, and Glenn Thrush. The piece is titled, The Final Days of the Trump White House, Chaos and Scattered Papers. Four days before the end of the Trump presidency, a White House aide peered into the Oval Office and was startled, if not exactly surprised, to see all of the president's personal photos still arrayed behind the Resolute desk, as if nothing had changed, guaranteeing the final hours would be a frantic dash mirroring the prior 4 years. In the area known as the Outer Oval Office, boxes have been brought in to pack up desks used by President Donald J. Trump's assistant and personal aides. But documents were strewn about, and the boxes stood nearly empty. The table in Donald Trump's private dining room off the Oval Office was stacked high with papers until the end, as it had been for his entire term. Upstairs in the White House residence, there were, however, a few signs that Donald Trump had finally realized his time was up. Papers he had accumulated in his last several months in office had been dropped into boxes, roughly 24 of them, and not sent to the National Archives. Aides had even retrieved letters from Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, and given them to Donald Trump in the final weeks, according to notes described to the New York Times. Where all of that material ended up is not clear, but what is plain, though, is that Mr. Trump's haphazard handling of government documents, a chronic problem, contributed to the chaos he created after he refused to accept his loss in the November 2020 presidential election, unleashed a mob on Congress, and set the stage for his second impeachment. His unwillingness to let go of power, including refusing to return government documents collected while he was in office, has led to a potentially damaging and entirely avoidable legal battle that threatens to engulf the former president and some of his aides. Although the White House counsel's office had told Mark Meadows, Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, that the roughly 24 boxes worth of material in the residence needed to be turned over to the National Archives, at least some of those boxes, including those with the Kim letters and some documents marked highly classified, were shipped to Florida. There, they were stored at various points over the past 19 months in different locations inside Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's members-only club, home and office, according to several people briefed on the events. Those actions, along with Donald Trump's protracted refusal to return the documents in Florida to the National Archives, prompted the Justice Department to review the matter early this year. This month, prosecutors obtained a warrant to search Mar-a-Lago for remaining materials, including some related to sensitive national security matters. The investigation is active and expanding, according to recent court filings, as prosecutors look into potentially serious violations of the Espionage Act and obstruction of justice. Many questions about the mishandling of the documents led to Donald Trump, who often treated the presidency as a private business. But people in his orbit also highlight the role of Mark Meadows, who oversaw what there was of a presidential transition. Mark Meadows assured aides that the hurried packing up of the White House would follow requirements about the preservation of documents, and he said he would make efforts to ensure that the administration complied with the Presidential Records Act, according to people familiar with those conversations. But as the clock ticked down, Donald Trump focused on pushing through last-minute pardons and largely ignored the transition he had tried to forestall. A spokesman for Donald Trump did not respond to a request for comment. Mr. Trump himself has denounced the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago as a witch hunt. His office has said he had a standing order that materials removed from the Oval Office and taken to the White House residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them, although none of the three potential crimes cited in the FBI's search warrant depend on whether removed documents are classified. A lawyer for Mark Meadows has declined to comment. In his final speech as president, Donald Trump declared, "We were not a regular administration." His statement was indisputably accurate. From his first hours in office, Donald Trump had always taken a proprietary view of the presidency, describing government documents and other property, even his staff, as his own personal possessions. "They're mine," is how he often put it, according to former aides. But that was not the case. Under the Presidential Records Act, the law that strictly governs the handling of records generated in the Oval Office, every document belongs to taxpayers, whether the materials were national security briefings, reams of unclassified documents automatically uploaded to a secure server in Pennsylvania, or notes that Donald Trump routinely ripped up or flushed down the toilet, all were government property to be assessed and, in most cases, transferred as part of the nation's history to the National Archives. Donald Trump's lawyers and aides were well-versed in the Records Act, even if Donald Trump routinely flouted it. Donald F. McGahn, Mr. Trump's first White House counsel, instituted a protocol for the proper handling of materials and gave presentations under law to staff members, former officials, according to former officials. After the 2020 presidential election, White House officials held conversations about the fact that someone needed to retrieve documents that Mr. Trump had accumulated in the residence over many months, according to former officials. By the end of the Trump administration, the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and his deputy, Patrick Philbin, were keenly aware that Mr. Trump's handling of documents was a potential problem, according to people in their orbit. But it is unclear how much bandwidth either man had to deal with the issue. Donald Trump was on contentious terms with Mr. Cipollone after the election and often berated the lawyer for objecting to his attempts to subvert Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory, according to former officials. Adding to the disarray was the absence of the White House Staff Secretary Derek Lyons, who managed paperwork inside the executive complex but had stepped down on 18th of December 2020. That left Mark Meadows, a former House member with no significant executive experience before joining Donald Trump's staff, responsible for overseeing a transition process the president wanted no part of. Mark Meadows' immediate predecessors in that role, President Barack Obama's last chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, and President George W. Bush's final chief of staff, Joshua Bolton, had created teams to scrub West Wing offices of anything that belonged to the National Archives and made the stewardship of government records a priority. But it is unclear whether Mark Meadows took the same measures, according to former aides. But in the administration's final weeks, the White House emailed all of its offices detailed instructions about returning documents and cleaning out their spaces. Mark Meadows followed up on those notes and encouraged officers to comply, according to a person familiar with those conversations. Mark Meadows also assured White House staff members that he would talk to Donald Trump about securing records, including ones stashed in the residence, according to two people with knowledge of the situation. Regardless of whether Mark Meadows followed through on those promises, by early 2021, after Donald Trump had left the White House, officials with the archives realized they were missing significant material. They reached out to, among others, Scott Garst, who had been a lawyer in the White House counsel's office under Donald Trump, and to Mr. Philbin. The two men, along with Mark Meadows and four other Trump officials, had been appointed by Donald Trump on his last full day in office to work with the National Archives. The archivists were particularly insistent about getting back the missing correspondence from the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and a letter left on the Resolute desk for Donald Trump by Barack Obama, both of significant historical value. Archives officials also asked Mr. Garst and Mr. Philbin about the roughly 24 boxes that had been in the residence during the Trump administration's final days. Mr. Philbin responded that he would work to get them in the hands of the National Archives and reached out to Mark Meadows, who said he would help make it happen, according to former officials. But archives officials did not get what they wanted until they travelled to Mar-a-Lago and retrieved 15 boxes of materials in January of 2022. Subsequently, archives officials told Donald Trump's team that they had identified social media records that had not been preserved, and that they had learned White House staff members had not preserved official business they had conducted on their personal electronic messaging accounts. They referred the matter to the Justice Department. In the spring, both Mr. Philbin and Mr. Gast were questioned by the FBI about the documents and the boxes. Pat Cipollone was also interviewed at some point. A grand jury was formed. In June, one of Donald Trump's lawyers signed a statement asserting that all relevant documents with classified markings from the boxes that had been requested, by then they were stored in a basement area at Mar-a-Lago, had been returned. The Justice Department would later file a detailed affidavit to a federal judge in Florida, revealing that the department believed possible crimes had been committed, precipitating the search of Mar-a-Lago on Monday, 8th of August.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha.
One day, the field of jihad is the military field, such as during the sacred defense and in defending the holy shrines. In such cases, the field is a military one. In those days, many individuals correctly understood their duty and carried it out. Of course, it was an obligation that required a number of people to do it. It was not compulsory for everyone to do it. In that field as well, the Hay'ats carried out their duty in full, as I explained before. Many of our soldiers and our martyrs were members of Hay'ats. And then one day, the field of jihad is a scientific field. In this field, one must work to improve the level of science in the country. And one day, the field of jihad includes social activities and public services for the people. That day is when the enemy is trying to exert economic pressures on society, thus pitting the people against Islam and the Islamic government. If you render economic and social services to the people at such a time, you're actually doing jihad to confront the enemy. However, the most important field is the field of clarification and enlightenment. If there is clarification, all these fields will become clear in the right circumstances, and the people will find their path on their own.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have reliable information that today a multitude of media sources that cannot even be counted, especially due to the circumstances in the internet, are busy working using thousands of experts. These are experts in the arts, media and communication who are backed by substantial financial support and also support in terms of security. For what goal? They wish to turn around minds and opinions in the Islamic Republic and to weaken and destroy faith and belief. This is how things are. What plots are being devised for other countries is another discussion. The things that I am talking about are the schemes that are designed for our country, our people, our Islamic Republic, and our beliefs. Thousands of institutions are working with huge amounts of money and various kinds of support. Well, this is a satanic move made by Shaitan's camp. What stands up to Shaitan's camp? The camp of struggle and jihad on the way of Allah. Well, you are the Hay'ats. You should ask your own Hay'at where it stands in this jihad.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.